Welcome to Holden Village. Today is Friday, July the 28th, 1995. In the fireside room this afternoon, our speaker is Walt Bowman, and he will be speaking on An Introduction to Theology, From the Resurrection On. Let's listen in.
I thought I'd just read a couple of, this is from a book called 1911 of the Best Things Anybody Ever Said. And I don't think that it's for sale in the bookstore, but there are some interesting comments on death and dying here. Rich Anderson says, perhaps there is no life after death, there's only Los Angeles. Oh, I love it. Let's see. Okay, Woody Allen, of course, has said a lot of things. Dying is one of the few things that can be done as easily lying down. I'm not afraid to die, I just don't want to be there when it happens. And here's Johnny Carson. This is my favorite. For 3 days after death, the hair and the fingernails continue to grow, but phone calls taper off. This is what we've been doing this week, and it really all started because John Parfit in the bookstore said I should come and do an afternoon tour of the bookstore and see if we couldn't sell some of his books there. And I looked around at what he had to sell, and he had some C.S. Lewis, a whole shelf full, and he had some Tillich, and he had some Bonhoeffer, and but actually, when I thought, he has a lot more there, so it really wasn't quite just to sell books. But when I thought about it, it made a lot of sense, just these three, because systematic theology is basically apologetic. I've said this every day, and I'll say it one more time, that apologetics is a way of making a case for the faith, because between the time that the great Christian sources emerged, the New Testament, the great creeds and the dogmatic formulations of the church, and even up through and including the Reformation, all of these resources come from a religious world, or at least a world that people understood religiously. Bonhoeffer called it yesterday the religious a priori, by which he means that people fundamentally understood God to be the driving power behind everything that happened. And we do not. My colleague, former colleague Ron Halls, used to say that if he would do a miracle in class, his students would not say, God has visited and redeemed his people. They would say, do it again slowly. And I think that's exactly true, you see. 500 years ago, we had what I would call the God theory of disease. Today we do not. We have the germ theory of disease or whatever. But nobody goes around thinking that colds or influenza or pneumonia or whatever is caused by God or caused by failure to obey God, caused by demons. We simply don't think in those terms. Whereas 100 years ago, 1,000 years ago, people would, if they were sick, go first to the priest, and then maybe as a last resort to the doctor. Today we go first to the Mayo Clinic, and as a last resort to Oral Roberts. And I think, well, these things are important for us to understand because we do not live in a fundamentally religious world, or at least a world that is understood by religion. Our normal way of understanding our world is not in terms of God. And there's nothing wrong with that. I'm not even saying that there is something wrong with that. I'm just saying let's be very clear about the kind of world that all of us live in. Now, to that world, Lewis said that what he rejected at age 12, he recovered again at age 31. That's the story of C.S. Lewis's conversion. And his path is first to theism. He becomes a theist, a believer in the existence of a supernatural God, and then a Christian. Some years later, in fact, about 2 years after he became a theist and started going back to church, he became a Christian. And what he means by becoming a Christian is he believed that Jesus is God. And what he recovers is a kind of classical Christian orthodoxy, complete with especially miracle, the intervention of the supernatural in the natural world. Paul Tillich comes to all of this in a quite different way. He draws on his Lutheran heritage to redefine both God and faith. God as ultimate concern, whatever concerns us ultimately, and faith as the act of having an ultimate concern. And thus what Tillich does, add once again that Lewis continues then to be able to define the world into believers and unbelievers, religious and non-religious. Tillich wipes out that distinction and does so in quite Lutheran terms by saying all of us have an ultimate concern, and the argument really ought to be over whether or not what we are concerned with ultimately is worth the effort. That is, whether it can bear the weight of being ultimate. And the crucial indicator of whether or not what we regard as ultimate is in fact ultimate is that we end up being the defenders, the protectors of a false ultimate, rather than it grasping us. We become its champions and function very destructively when our ultimates are attacked. Bonhoeffer, also drawing on his Lutheran heritage, says that the challenge for us is how to believe in Christ how to rescue Christ in a sense from being religious. what happens, you see, if we have a religionless way of receiving Christ? That way, he says, is to receive or to recover the suffering God rather than the religious God in an irreligious world. So he fixes on the suffering Christ as the true picture of God. Here again, one sees and hears echoes of Luther. Where do we see into the heart of God? In the cross and nowhere else. For there God is suffering on behalf of and at the hands of the world. Now, all of these people were formed, had their formative experiences prior to the Second World War. Tillich in the First World War, in the trenches, C.S. Lewis also fought and was wounded in World War I, and essentially has to deal with the post-World War I world. Bonhoeffer, born in 1906, half a generation after Lewis and a full generation after Tillich, is dominated by and eventually executed by the demonic forces in Germany in World War II. But the people that I want to talk about today are all post-World War II. That's why I put birth dates on the blackboard for at least a couple of them. I'm not sure of Carl's, but I think he's about as old as I am. I'm 66. I was born in 1929. and Bob Jensen is about 1931, I would guess, if I were going to put it on the board. Pannenberg was born in 1928, grew up in the Hitler years, was in fact a member of the Hitler Youth. At the end of World War II, however, as he is a high school student now, in a day in January, I think it was probably Epiphany in 1945, had a powerful, powerful religious experience, which he still will talk about as an experience of God. It was an experience of enormous illumination for him, and it turned his life around. He was, in 1945, a 17-year-old boy, and went looking then for this God whom he experienced in an epiphany, in an actual epiphany, and has, in a sense, altered and defined the very way in which European and a lot of American Protestants do theology. Jürgen Moltmann actually saw some service in World War II, but he was one of those tag-end conscripts that Hitler drafted desperately at the end to try to save Germany. Both of them studied then theology in post-World War II Germany, and both of them wrote books that start with the resurrection. Pannenberg wrote a book called Jesus, God, and Man in 1964, and Moltmann wrote a book called Theology of Hope in 1965, both of which were translated into English almost immediately, and Moltmann's at least was a bit of a sensation. Broughton, sometime after that, wrote a book called Theology of Hope, and Jensen published shortly after that a book called Story and Promise. But all of them operate with a fundamental premise, namely that the starting point for Christian proclamation is, of all things, the resurrection of Jesus. Now, the question with which they are all willing to wrestle is how we have access to something as strange to a world like ours as the resurrection. Pannenberg addressed that question in an essay that was published together with three other young Heidelberg scholars called Offenbarung als Geschichte, Revelation as History. It was published in 1960, and I was at Heidelberg in 62, 63, finishing up my own doctoral work, and Pannenberg had begun teaching at the University of Mainz, but the people with whom he wrote the book, the Rentdorf brothers and Ulrich Wilkens, were still at Heidelberg, and I knew them all. It was a shocking book, because what these young scholars were saying is that if Christianity does not have a historical basis, there is no Christianity. That's for starters. An echo of Paul's, if Christ be not raised, your faith is vain. But they made the further claim that the resurrection is accessible to us as history. In other words, we have as much access to the resurrection of Jesus as we do to the death of Socrates. Well, that's an astonishing claim. In Pannenberg's work, it is grounded in a brilliant investigation by the teacher that both of us had, Hans von Kampenhausen, who taught early Christianity at the University of Heidelberg. Von Kampenhausen always lectured at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and he lectured for 2 hours, 4 to 6. And he always took a break at 4:45 or so, 4:50, and would light up a lengthy cigar, which he could not finish in the 10-minute break. So he'd come back after the break and pace back and forth in front of the classroom, smoking this cigar, but having no place to go with the ash. And we would always watch that ash grow longer and longer and wonder when it was going to fall off, you know? Von Kampenhausen, I should say, was a marvelous scholar and a brilliant lecturer. And he had earlier on published an essay called Das Ostergeschehen und der leere Grab, The Event of Easter and the Empty Tomb. And what he did was to try to work backwards from Paul's testimony in 1 Corinthians 15. I delivered to you as of first importance what I also received, how Christ died according to the scriptures and was buried and was raised on the third day according to the scriptures. And what von Kampenhausen shows is that that we know the date when Paul wrote 1 Corinthians 15. We know it within about a 12-month period because of the reference to the Roman governor of Corinth, who was there just 18 months. And so we can date 1 Corinthians, or at least that snippet of it, to about the year 51 AD. And now, working backwards very carefully, he asks, what was the fate of this tradition formula that Paul repeats? And Pannenberg comes back to within about a year to a year and a half of the actual date of the crucifixion and resurrection of Jesus. So we have at least as close to that event, says von Kampenhausen, as we are to the death of Socrates. I mean, there were no cameras, no video cameras or tape recorders there. And we have only Plato's account of the death of Socrates, which is much farther from the event than, let's say, Paul's bit of tradition in 1 Corinthians 15. So historically, Pannenberg says, we can get quite close to the event, we can get quite close to the actual date in terms of the reports that we have. But equally important, we can look at the very nature of the reports themselves and find that they bear all the earmarks of a historically accurate or reasonably accurate account. What are some of these? One of these, the best book, if you want a short one to get a hold of some of these things, is a book by the English scholar James D.G. Dunn, D-U-N-N, who some years ago published a little volume called The Evidence for Jesus. And both of them point to the, both Pannenberg and Dunn point to the fact that the accounts we have of resurrection appearances do not agree on all the details. They in fact, there's quite a bit of disagreement about the particulars. Who are the women who go to the tomb? How many women go to the tomb? Do they encounter someone outside or inside the tomb? Do they encounter one or two personages? Are the grave clothes of Jesus rolled up or not? There are discrepancies on virtually all of these things in the accounts. But this is actually a sign of the fundamental veracity of what is there, because we don't have a kind of cooked up story. Everybody's saying, well, let's all get the story straight and tell it in the same way. In fact, there are a variety of traditions about the appearances, but they do have some things in common. One is that the grave is indeed empty. The grave is indeed empty. Dunn points out that there's a kind of negative verification of this because it was the custom in the Israel at the time of Jesus that the graves of venerated teachers became places for cultic prayer very quickly after death. And that people went around trying to gather the artifacts of their deceased rabbis for the simple reason that this is one of the ways in which you have access to people who are dead. We do the same sort of thing with Luther. I was in Eisleben, where Luther died in 1985. And the room in which Luther died is preserved exactly as it was when he died. He was the most famous man in Germany. You can see the little cupboard bed in which he lay, the room, the shroud in which his body was initially wrapped, little crumpled piece of paper on which he wrote his final words, "Wir sind Bettler, das ist wahr," we are beggars, that's the only truth, and it's all there. And the reason it's all there is because we have no other access to Luther today except the artifacts. You see, he's dead. But nothing like that happens with regard to Jesus. What's astonishing is that the quest for places like where is the upper room, where was the hill of crucifixion, where might the tomb be, and so on, that doesn't happen for centuries. Constantine's mother is the one who goes off to Israel and Palestine and tries to find the places and to discover where Jesus might have done this or that. My faith isn't strong enough to go to Israel yet. I don't want to be, you know, I don't know whether there ever was a Sermon on the Mount, you see. They'll take you to a place. But Luke has a Sermon on the Plain, and he's got the same passages scattered through six or seven chapters that Matthew brings all together in what we have come to call the Sermon on the Mount. There's no way today that we're ever going to discover the upper room where the Lord's Supper was celebrated. There's a theory now that the hill, which people have said sort of looks like a skull, an outcropping of rock, may not have anything to do with why it was called Place of the Skull, that people, crucifixion victims, were not buried. They were simply left to rot, and their bones were there, and so you just kicked a couple of skulls aside and put up your scaffolding or whatever it was for new victims. And so that looking for a geographical place that might look like a skull is a lost cause, unnecessary. But we didn't even begin to do that for centuries. The disciples didn't because they didn't think Jesus was dead anymore. In addition to that, the women, while we may not know the exact identity of all of the women or how many women went to the tomb, the point is that in all the accounts except Paul's, they are the first witnesses. Now here is where inclusive language gets us into some difficulty because it misses the point. When Paul is listing the witnesses of the resurrection, they're all men in 1 Corinthians 15, and including the more than 500 brethren. The new RSV translates that brothers and sisters. Paul must be rolling over in his grave. He didn't intend any cistern to be in there at all. He wanted only brethren. The reason is simple. In Jewish and Hellenistic culture, women were not reliable witnesses. And Paul is above all trying to tell the Corinthians, Jesus is risen. You see, that's the point of his proclamation there. And he's not going to convince them if he adduces women witnesses. So he has none. But a half a generation later, You see, in all of the narratives that we have, the women are sometimes the only witnesses. Mark has no other witnesses. And in Luke, the men don't believe the women. Well, of course they wouldn't believe them. Why would anybody believe women at that time, you see? That's at least making the point. So if Paul can succeed in giving accounts of the resurrection without any women, why introduce them unless you have to? Because it surely doesn't strengthen your case. But you can't tell the story truthfully without women, even if that damages your case. It's part of God's great humor, I guess, that doesn't make the case in one century makes it in another. You know, it's almost funny. The Lord surely must laugh. So women are there. And then I think the third thing is that in the appearances, the common characteristic is that they are surprised and terrified. They are not experiencing what they expect to experience. They are experiencing something that they don't expect to experience, and that in fact is quite terrifying. We do not have a soap opera happy ending in the narratives. We have something quite different. And the difference becomes even more clear when the appearances end in disappearances. And Luke, in his tidy little way, even gives us a kind of two ascension narratives, one at the end of the first gospel, the third gospel, and then one at the beginning of the book of Acts. And the disappearances tell us that what we have in the resurrection narratives is not a resuscitation of a dead body who continues to function or pick up where he left off before the crucifixion and functions until eventual death. Resuscitations are probably what we have in some of the other gospel narratives, the young man from Nain or the story of Lazarus or something like that. But with Jesus, it's not a resuscitation. Jesus is beyond death, and that's the critical point. If we look at Acts 2, just as an example of the earliest proclamation, if we look at Acts 2 and see what Peter is saying, we notice several, I think, very significant things. The first is that Peter's proclamation is indeed proclamation of news. Jesus is risen, or Jesus is the Messiah, or the reign of God has come. That's an announcement of something having happened. And so Peter does not say, Christ died for you. That's not the good news. In fact, it's quite the reverse. He is addressing the very people who were involved in some sense in the crucifixion, either as people who had demanded it or as people who knew about it. And he's saying, men of Israel, he's addressing this to Jews, hear these words, Jesus of Nazareth, etc., whom you crucified and killed, but God raised him up, and we are witnesses. Now that's a consistent proclamation. Very early in the months and years after the death of Jesus on the cross, and one needs to call attention to the fact that it was addressed to Jews, it was addressed to those who had engaged in the crucifixion, and which the resurrection of Jesus now confronts, and which calls them to some kind of action and response. They are baptized in large numbers, the book of Acts tells us, but into what? Into a movement, not an institution, but a movement, first of all, a Jewish movement. It doesn't international or universal character until the conversion of Paul. And then we have the incident of Peter, the vision of Peter with the foods that are unclean, and he is sent to Cornelius, the Roman. And then by Acts 13, we are in full swing into the sort of universalization of what starts out only among Jews. But that too has its roots in Jewish messianic expectation. For the Messiah is to be a universal Messiah. And that's exactly what we find Peter and the others proclaiming. The Messiah has come. The crucified one has been attested as the Messiah by the resurrection. Paul says the same thing at the beginning of Romans. See, we all think that Romans 16:17 is sort of the heart of the gospel, but Paul says what the gospel is already in Romans 1. I want to read that to you. I mean, Romans 1:1. Paul, a servant of Jesus Christ, called to be an apostle, set apart for the gospel of God, which is now the gospel concerning his son, descended from David according to the flesh, designated son of God in power according to the spirit of holiness by his resurrection from the dead. Both of these, son of David, son of God, messianic terms. That's the gospel. And then Paul goes on to say what its implications are. Now, Pannenberg asks, what are we to make of all of this? See, the first thing he's saying is, it happened. The second thing he's saying is, we have access to it as a historical event. And now the question is, what are we to make of it? That's basically the thrust of Moltmann's theology of hope. Pannenberg here introduces a concept that's now almost become religious jargon. The resurrection is a proleptic act. Proleptic. All right. What does prolepsis mean? Prolepsis means that you see the outcome or the end of history in its midst somewhere. The way I understand this is by telling people how I read mystery stories. I hate to fly on airplanes, and so I always buy a mystery so I have something to read while I'm on the airplane. And the way I read mystery stories is to read the last chapter first. I always want to find out how it ends. This is quite important because I see who the characters are at the end, and I don't invest any emotional energy in characters that aren't going to be around at the end. I have too little emotional energy available, so I have to husband it carefully. But the second thing is that it changes the way I participate in the story. I can't always do this with P.D. James, whom I like very, very much. She is, her mystery stories rise to the level of literature, and they often end in ways that are not very conclusive. They're not like Agatha Christie, who ties up everything in nice little bows and ribbons at the end. But even P.D. James, I want to read the last chapter first, because it changes the way I participate in the story, especially if it's a complex story, and if the mystery writer will have you looking at all kinds of possibilities. I'm able to see where the leads are, where the clues are planted, where the solution is already sort of indicated along the way. It changes the way I participate in the story. That's what Pannenberg means by a proleptic understanding of the resurrection. The disciples encounter Jesus as the last chapter in the middle. And so when Luke tells the ascension story, it's not a farewell. It's not a last goodbye. I was in Leipzig in 1985 for the anniversary of Bach's, the 300th anniversary of Bach's birth. And on Ascension Day in the evening, I went to the Nikolaikirche, where they did both the Easter and the Ascension oratorios of Bach. Gorgeous music. But the text for the Ascension Oratorio, now Bach could have set the telephone directory to music and it would have been great, but the Ascension libretto is particularly bad. The disciples are saying things like, oh dear Jesus, please don't leave us, you know, and he's comforting them, and it's a tender last farewell, and it's a bunch of nonsense. It has nothing to do with the Gospel of Luke or the Acts of the Apostles. Luke tells us, in fact, that they returned to Jerusalem rejoicing because they hadn't said goodbye. Well, this makes sense only if indeed they have read the last chapter, and Jesus is the last chapter, and therefore he is not gone. He is with them as the power of the future. For if you have read the last chapter, you participate in the novel differently, but history is not a novel. You are participating in history differently if you have read the last chapter. And you have even a chance to change history, because a novel is copyrighted, but history is not, you see. And what this means then is, where is the power of God in history if we no longer believe in a religious interpretation of the world? The power of God in history is quite simply in those who have been grasped by the last chapter, by the outcome, who know that life and not death will have the last word. See, the alternative to the Gospel of Luke, or the Acts of the Apostles, or the New Testament, is Stephen Hawking, The Brief History of Time. We are headed, says Hawking, toward the big crunch. 10 billion years down the road, time is going to run out of steam. It will collapse back in on itself. We will all indeed get to live our lives over once more, backwards. Oh my. And then time will come back to its beginnings, and it isn't that we are no more. It's the ultimate in death. We will never have been. Do you see? I mean, it's worse than we will not, we are no more. It's we will never have been. Well, people who believe that are going to also buy whatever, is it Schlitz beer? You only go around once in life and you got to grab for all the gusto you can. Was that the Schlitz commercial? It was, wasn't it? I mean, see, if that's the last chapter, boy, then you are going to just grab gusto, because it's the only sensible thing to do, at whose ever expense. But if Jesus has the last word, there is something quite different to do with your lives. You can now offer them. You can now invest them in the world. So, in a sense, what we have now are alternative futures laid out before us. And the question is, which of them do you believe? Right? Stephen Hawking acknowledges that he has no more evidence for his big crunch than I do for believing that Jesus of Nazareth will have the last word. I think that's the way in which Pannenberg wants to make the case. He wants to say, yes, let's take the resurrection, that's the starting point in the New Testament, it's the reason for everything, and then let's see how we do theology on that basis. If Jesus has the last word, we're back in Tillich territory again, aren't we? What does it mean to confess that Jesus is God? Not C.S. Lewis's miracle that the infinite becomes finite or the immortal becomes mortal. That's believing, like G.K. Chesterton said, three impossible things before breakfast. Some people will believe and some won't. So the world is once again divided into religious and non-religious people. What does it mean to confess Jesus is God? It means that he has the last word. For God means, in Tillich's term, ultimacy, in Pannenberg's sense, finality. But it's the same kind of thing, do you see? It's the same way of defining God. God is whoever or whatever has the last word. Article in the Christian Century. The question is not whether God is dead, said the article, but whether death is God, you see. For if death has the last word, that's what we ought to pay attention to. But if Jesus has the last word, then it makes sense very early in the New Testament for them to confess Jesus as God, as Paul does already in Philippians and in Romans and elsewhere, and then it just swells into a chorus. But now, what kind of God? If Jesus is God, then the retrieval of his past becomes an urgent task, and that is what we have immediately in the generation after Paul. You don't know anything about Jesus except that he was crucified and raised from Paul. That's all you know. But within half a generation then, Mark, Luke, Matthew come along, and finally John, the retrieval of the narrative of Jesus. And the earliest big block of tradition that we retrieve is the cross. So, what Paul ends up confessing is Jesus, the crucified one, has been raised and is the Messiah, and the reign of God has come, and it's open to Gentiles. Well, but now one has to say something quite shocking, that God died on the cross. We're into Bonhoeffer territory now, see? And the suffering of God is possible because we are retrieving the stories of Jesus as stories of God. So, on the basis of the resurrection, we can say Jesus is God. On the basis of the cross, we have to say God is more than Jesus. Because on the cross, Jesus calls out, my God, why have you abandoned me? And so the cross is the basis for the church's confession of the Trinity. Because the resurrection does not say, no, Jesus was not abandoned on the cross by the Father. The resurrection says, yes, Jesus was indeed abandoned on the cross by the Father, and thus abandonment is now taken up into God's being so that no one is ever abandoned. There is no place now so lonely, so dreadful, that God has not grasped it, enveloped it, and in the end overcome it. Ah. So the doctrine of the Trinity is not speculative. It is grounded in the cross, and it is the gospel itself. I didn't learn it as gospel. I learned it as mathematical nonsense. And when I raised any questions, I was always told some variation of shut up and believe. But what I was being asked to believe was nonsense, not the gospel, you see. Well, I think it's wonderful to discover that the reason why they confessed the Father and the Son and their Spirit as the Christian understanding of God is because that's what the Christian gospel is. That's good news. The Spirit, Paul's word for the Spirit is down payment. When you make a down payment on a car, you can drive it off the lot as if it were already yours. So what do the earliest disciples of Jesus experience? They experience the Spirit as the finality of history already happening to them, already available to them. They're living as if, in fact, Jesus has the last word, as if, in fact, the kingdom of God has come, you see. So one can now distinguish the Holy Spirit from evil or demonic spirit. That's the contrast. Demonic spirit makes itself present when a whole nation can be seized by the Nazi ideology. A British reporter in 1936 wrote about, who had total antipathy to Hitler, wrote about going to a party rally in Nuremberg. Hitler had built this huge Parteigelände, party acreage, or whatever, how you would translate that. You can still see the ruins of it. A stadium holding 250,000 people with a huge parade ground and a great tribunal at one end. Imagine now Albert Speer flooding the sky with 160 floodlights that feel like gigantic pillars around you, reaching up to a roof that you cannot see and enveloping all these people. And then thousands and thousands of disciplined troops marching in with flags flying and torches and everyone singing and the crowd being whipped up to a frenzy and Hitler bounding onto this tribunal and the crowd leaping to its feet shouting, "Sieg Heil, Sieg Heil," and he finds himself doing the same thing. I mean, he hates Hitler, but he is grasped by a magic, by a power that sweeps him to his feet too. And later he says, "What in the world was I doing?" That's spirit. But it is demonic spirit, given what it was that Hitler was up to, you see. Well, what about the disciples? They are grasped by a different vision, an alternative vision, a holy spirit. And not a demonic one. And there we have the origins of the triune God. What else emerges from all of this? Church, not as an institution initially, but as a movement. I think this is one of the reasons why we look in vain to the New Testament for any of the features of institution founders. We do not have a liturgy given us in the New Testament. We do not have a polity, a way of governing the church, given us in the New Testament. We don't have creeds and dogmas given us in the New Testament. We don't even have the New Testament given us in the New Testament. I mean, see, nobody says these 27 documents are now going to be your Holy Scripture. Contrast this with Mary Baker Eddy and Science and Health as the Key to the Scriptures, or the Book of Mormon, or the Quran. See, any religious founder, make sure you got the doctrines, the rituals, the governance, everything down pat. There's nothing like that in the New Testament, and for good reason. It's basically, its origins are a movement within Judaism that says Jesus is the Jewish Messiah. And if Messiah, then Judaism is going to be the gathering place for all nations, you see. It's only after Paul, third generation stuff, or at least second generation literature, that we finally begin to get the beginnings of institutionalization. After the rejection, the formal rejection by a rabbinic synod around 90 AD, we get institutionalization. The roots are there in the movement literature that we have. The New Testament is basically movement literature. I always compare this to the civil rights movement, you see. It had rituals, linking hands, marching, singing, "We Shall Overcome." It had leaders, but they weren't elected, and nobody knew how leadership was going to be passed on when Martin Luther King was assassinated. That's a movement, you see. And unless a movement becomes an institution, it either achieves its goals and can go out of business, or it dies and you never hear of it again. So institutionalization was necessary, but it comes post-New Testament. And the sequence is interesting. Earliest thing that we have is the meal to distinguish Christians, the Messianic meal. We have that already in Acts. We begin to get a liturgy after Paul. And we have one by the time of the beginning of the second century. A structure for what Christians do when they gather that is still what we do when we gather. We come together, we pay attention to the stories, the word, the teaching, we offer ourselves, we have a meal, and we are sent back into the world again. We are scattered. That's what Justin Martyr tells us. That's what Christians do. The second thing is we get bishops very early out of persecution. They're mentioned in the New Testament, but together with all kinds of other ministers. But finally, early in the second century in Asia Minor, the bishop becomes the rallying point for a persecuted community. The first mark of a bishop is... Are you ready to be the first one to die? Because they almost always were. How about that, huh? Seriously, you couldn't tell a bishop from a layman because they all wore the same kind of clothes. You could only tell who ate the bread and drank the cup first. And that's the one the secret police would grab and haul off to the lions. Well, that's why ministers started eating and drinking first. Not because they were in a hurry to get to the head of the line, but because that was the way in which the Romans could identify who the leaders were and thus get them. That's the way they protected their sheep. That's the way they were not false leaders. Do you understand? I mean, this is marvelous stuff. So polity develops out of the persecution of the church and out of the fact that the church is the enveloping community for Roman Christians, Christians in the Roman Greco-Roman world. The deacons were the ones who organized and provided the organizational strength of the Christian community. They took care of the widows and the orphans and the diaconal needs of a community that cared for people. They were, in fact, the administrators. The bishops were the martyrs, and the deacons ran the church. Interesting. Well, some of these things might not be all bad. The creeds. The earliest creeds were quite simple. Jesus is Lord. That's all you needed to say. Dangerous to say that because Caesar thought he was Lord. And religious people thought Apollo was the Lord. And so they went after these people who said Jesus is Lord. Out of that came the creeds in the 3rd, 4th, and 5th centuries. And finally, way at the end, without any conciliar action at all, gradually, the church settled on 27 books which could be read in worship, and we had a canon. The canon got selected from among hundreds of other documents, and if you look at them, you can see why these were picked and others were not. If one is doing theology in terms of the way things happened, the way things began, then you need to start with the resurrection, and you can develop a kind of systematic theology in terms of how the church became the kind of institution that it did. I haven't said anything about sin. The Christian gospel is basically a vision, not a therapy. It's what will be that gives Christians their authority. Along the way, one of the things they also want to do is heal, forgive, restore, cure. But that's one of the things that the vision allows us to do. It doesn't start out primarily as a kind of a divine repair job. dealing with sin. So if I were going to put my systematic theology together, I would put conversion as the last thing. You are converted from being a sinner, having false gods and so on, to being a Christian, and baptism would be the way in which we handle that. All right, well, I'm willing to stop here and let you fire away for a little bit. I commend to you Rowan Williams' beautiful little book called Resurrection, and James Dunn's book, The Evidence for Jesus, and Pannenberg's more massive stuff, Is Jesus God and Man, is a big, thick book, and Moltmann just keeps writing books. He has avoided doing a systematic theology, but he's just produced a whole bunch of books. Well, what do you say to this? Yeah, go ahead, Doug.
Karl Rahner is a fairly big name. Can you put him anywhere in this nice map that you've laid out?
Yes, as a matter of fact, except that I forgot to bring some Rahner stuff along. I have it here. Rahner says, I think it's in volume 11 of his collected essays, he has a beautiful essay there on the three sort of paragraphs that he thinks are absolutely essential for doing theology. He calls one, in English, a futurological paragraph. He says Christianity is about the future. He's with these guys up there. The second one is a theological paragraph. If Christianity has seen the future in Jesus, then it can say something about theos, about God, which is exactly the route I followed here. And then finally, he's got a sociological paragraph. What kind of church do you have? If Jesus discloses the future, and if he is our access to God, then what kind of church do you have? Those are his three paragraphs. He lays them out in very tight, abstract language, and then unpacks each one. That's, so Rahner is on the same wavelength with these people. But the problem with a Rahner, you see, is that he runs headlong into the official Roman Catholic way of describing the origins of Christianity in anachronistic terms. See, I do not want to read meal or bishop or creed or canon back into the New Testament. I think it's fine for us to just sort of let them develop. What Catholicism did in the Middle Ages was to say, now that we have the papacy, a primate in the West, we got to have Peter as the first pope. And we have to make Jesus then a religion founder. See, he designates Peter as the first pope, the apostles as the first bishops, the Eucharist as the first sacrament, and then you have missed both the historical Jesus and the historical origins of Christianity. So Rahner was not very well received, I guess that's the word, by his own church leadership.
But he was the inspiration behind, what's his name, Cardinal
Ratzinger?
Ratzinger?
Well, he was his teacher.
His teacher, student didn't learn, I mean.
Well, I don't know. I mean, Ratzinger was given a different job. He was called by John Paul II to shape everybody up, to bring people back in line again, that the church was getting out of hand. Rahner was the inspiration behind the Second Vatican Council. Rahner also taught Hans King and lots of other people who were at Rome from 1962 to 1965 and ushered in a kind of revolution.